Let me now introduce tonight's speakers. Four very experienced foreign correspondents from France, Germany, Italy, and Poland. The first is Marie Billon, UK correspondent for RTL and other French media. Second is Stephanie Bolzen, London correspondent of the German newspaper Die Welt. Third is Antonello Guerrera, UK correspondent for the Italian paper La Repubblica. And fourth is Jakub Krupa, UK correspondent for Polish media and former correspondent for the Polish press agency. Each of our speakers is going to talk for just 5 minutes at the start. We'll then have a panel discussion for 30 minutes or so before we open it up to Q&A. Abby Turner is going to collect the questions. If you want to ask your question direct, we'll ask you to unmute. But if you want Abby to put your question, that's fine. Please be understanding if your question's not selected, we may not be able to answer them all. The seminar will end at 7:15. So let me now invite Marie Billon to go first and give us a French perspective on Brexit. Marie, you're very welcome. Over to you.
Thank you, Professor. Hello, everyone. Nice to be here virtually with you. I wanted to start with the publishing of a book. A few days ago, the former French ambassador to the UK from 2014 to 2017, Sylvie Berman, published a book entitled Goodbye Britannia, the UK Facing the Brexit Challenge. She says in it that Boris Johnson is an inveterate liar. She says he lies to embellish reality, lies as a game, but also as an instrument of power. That's quite hot stuff, but that's not different to what President Macron said in January 2020. The Brexit campaign was made of lies, exaggeration, and simplification. But Sylvie Berman also offers an explanation as to why she thinks it's so easy for the PM to lie. She says Boris Johnson thought maybe that belonging to the caste of former Etonians and Oxford students allowed him his freedom with words and provocations. France definitely has an obsession with class and poshness, if I can say. Privileges have been abolished in France. That stems from the revolution, of course, but we keep a very keen interest in countries that have kept their royal family and effectively their class system. We tend to explain everything or almost everything that's different between France and the UK through those two prisms. I've spent a good chunk of my time in 2020 working as a researcher for a TV documentary entitled First, Boris Johnson's England. That was a working title. It soon turned out to be Boris Johnson's Great Britain and then Boris Johnson's United Kingdom minus Wales. All that to say that the take of the documentary was that Boris Johnson's poshness explained a lot of him. That was the take of the documentary. But it's also interesting to note with these different titles over the weeks, basically, when we started the documentary, the understanding of the UK's unity and sense of identities is something that's very hard to grasp for a country that is as centralized as France. So, of course, what stands out for us when we look at the UK is that there is a queen and there are posh boys, and now there is Brexit. Another new way that the British have found to be different from us. But at the same time, when you are a foreign correspondent, like I am, what you have to do is talk about things that resonate with your audience, the French audience for me. It has to make sense for them because it has to remain engaging. For example, this documentary was focusing on Boris Johnson because he is a fascinating personality, whatever you think of him, but also because France still needs providential men. No women providential in France as yet, I must say. And because Boris Johnson has a grasp on power that is arguably more forceful than, say, Theresa May, he does fit the profile of the strong providential men. In a way, Boris Johnson made Brexit more understandable to a French audience, because it became quite straightforward as soon as he got his majority. The ups and downs of Theresa May's premiership were harder to make sense of most of the time. And I think we all remember the catastrophic anticipated election chosen by Theresa May in 2017, the one when she lost the slim majority that she had. I would ask the question if there was an audience, but the question would be, do you know how you pronounce Theresa May in French? Well, in French, Theresa May pronounced Jacques Chirac. That was the online news media Slate.fr who wrote that in 2017. That's a reference to the election called by Jacques Chirac in 1997 when he had a majority and ended up losing it, the majority, I mean, having to cohabitate with the socialist Lionel Jospin. As you can see, it can be quite fun to compare countries, habits and mistakes, but sometimes it also becomes disingenuous, I would say. One of the first assignments I was given to do after the shock of the Brexit result in 2016 was finding people who regretted voting Brexit. The result was not what we expected, so we had to make sense of it somehow in our own way, so regrets were very much of interest. Sylvie Berman also said in an interview to The Guardian for the book she published, to see all that blown up deliberately and for what, a blind belief in some mythical idea. We often say the difference between France and the UK is that Britain and British people base their self-identity on history and France and the French people on ideas, principle and philosophy. But they both have something in common, and that's illusion or disillusion, I will say. Britain has a reconstructed idea of its own past. I would recommend everyone to watch Lucy Wolseley's recent BBC documentary on the Blitz period on that front. And in France, it takes the form of, we have principles and we must stand firm, arguably, that means not going forward and resisting every reform. Brexit is the biggest reform in modern times. No wonder French people are bewildered. The proof, I would say, is in the pudding. Since Frexit is less of a possibility that it was in 2016. After all, if we Frexited, we would erase some of the differences between France and the UK, and both our countries need to be exceptional.
Thank you, Marie. Vive la différence. I remember Sylvie Berman as being a very generous host in the French Embassy. She's much missed. Our next speaker is Stephanie Bolzen, to give us a German perspective. Stephanie, the correspondent from Die Welt, over to you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. And Marie just said you shouldn't compare countries, and you certainly shouldn't compare countries, in this case, Germany and the United Kingdom, when it comes to humor. But I thought I start with a little bit of humor. I try to share my screen in a minute, just for 1 minute. And show you a little clip from a Heute show. This is a show that is very popular in Germany. It's on the second television every Friday night at 10:30. And I guess since the Brexit referendum, every 3 months at least, Brexit was worth a long clip in this Heute show. Just a little warning, it might be a little bit raw, the humor, but I'll show it now. I try to show it now and will explain why and what it tells us about Germany. Right, just a very, very short clip from that. What does it tell us in a way? Brexit has, while obviously this was something that people suffered or loved much more in United Kingdom, because it is what this country voted for or did not vote for, and which now means that this nation has left the European Union. I think, many countries in Europe have very much been felt part of this process, but Germany, I think, is especially close to the United Kingdom. And if you look at this clip again, you can also see, in a way, there was something educational in this. People binge watched John Bercow, they binge watched the votes on Brexit. People were kind of astonished and fascinated by the chaos, the ongoing chaos. They were very sympathetic in the beginning. Many people also felt sorry. So many people have friends, they have studied here. I think this changed a little bit with the election to being the leader of Boris Johnson back in 2019. If you look at the German media at the time, it was always very critical about Brexit. It became also very raw. There were titles like of Der Spiegel, which is the most sold quality magazine in Germany, that was on their front page having a caricature of the Prime Minister. There were very harsh comments. So the perception of Britain, it became a bit, and I'm just saying this really in a neutral way, sometimes you would think it's a banana republic. And I don't think that this was very helpful, because in the end, we continue to be neighbors and you continue to have to work together. And this drove Brexiteers off, obviously, even more into a corner. If you now think I mean, since 2016, the relationship has been very much a roller coaster. So it has been Brexit, the sadness, almost the grieving of Britain leaving. Also in the German government, the very acute awareness how important Britain is in the European Union as a security partner, transatlantic partnership, and so on. The question of Trump and Boris Johnson, Angela Merkel very often was presented as the only one who was preserving and protecting Western liberalism. And then it became more and more difficult with the deal. Then the deal was finally struck. And then COVID struck. And in a way, that then was the sequence of the Brexit drama, because you could see how difficult, how much was Britain struggling. And that was very much reported, of course, in Germany, because Boris Johnson was so slow to react. Now, talking about this roller coaster, this has now completely changed because of the very successful vaccine rollout in Britain. There is an absolutely chaotic and disastrous vaccine rollout back in Germany. This has completely changed. And coming back to the obsession and how close the countries are, I just printed out, I hope you can see that. This is Bild. It's like the English Sun. I think this was last week. And it says, we envy you, Britain, we envy you. And then the Sun responded, we do not envy you. So you can see there's a lot of, I mean, it starts with the football and it ends with politics. It's going back and forth. There's massively reporting on Britain in Germany. I think, unfortunately, much less reporting or much less diversity reporting in the UK about Germany. And of course, we will see in a couple of months, the vaccine rollout in Germany and Europe will hopefully be better. But the reporting is intense. The last years, of course, have changed massively the image of Britain in Germany, not only because of the media, because people traveled here, they have a lot of relationships here. And I think we are now starting to understand the effect and the impact by starting with Erasmus that doesn't exist anymore as it did, au pairs that can't work in Britain anymore, the Northern Ireland problem. So we are facing, I think, now really the reality of Brexit, and hopefully we will find a way through. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie. And let's go straight away to our next speaker from Italy. Antonello Guerrera. Antonello, over to you.
Thank you very much, Professor Edel, and thank you for your invitation. I would like to talk about political analysis between the cases of the UK and Italy. I won't be long, but We know, of course, that I mean there is a huge connection between the UK and Italy in terms of the Italian community here in the UK, in terms of trade and all the normal stuff. But I think that there is also a very interesting connection in terms of Brexit, because this is not very known, I think, I mean, abroad, but Italy has now a big part of Eurosceptics. I mean, despite being, unlike the UK, despite being a founding father of the EU, as we know it now, Italy has also, after the introduction of the euro currency, Italy has always seen the chunk of the Eurosceptics in its country grow more and more across the years. I mean, over the years, sorry. Resulted in two polls conducted by the European Parliament in 2019 and last year as well, in which you can see that the Italians, according to this poll, are the less happy, I mean, are the least happy to be in the EU. This, I'm saying this, I mean, there are a number of reasons for that. I mean, first of all, as I said, the introduction of the euro currency that had a powerful impact on Italy's economy. This also is very interesting in my opinion, because Brexit in Italy is felt in a very partisan, divisive way, like it is also in the UK. I'm saying this because because of this big wave of Euroscepticism that Italy has been experiencing now for a number of recent years, all the fortunes and the misfortunes of Brexit in the UK have always a repercussion, always an impact on the Italian public, and you can see, like, especially when you have, I mean, I see that you know, personally, when I report something, you know, that a kind of good outcome on Brexit, and I can see, I mean, the number of people commenting on the line that are very much in the favor, and on the other hand, it happens basically the contrary in the case of some negative report on Brexit. I'm saying this because we now, I mean, in this now, I mean, Italy has another technocratic government led by Mario Draghi, the former ECB president, and it's quite similar to what happened with Mario Monti more or less a decade ago. But we don't have to consider now, because we have a very celebrated Europhile now at the end of of the Italian government, we don't have to think that Euroscepticism doesn't exist anymore. Actually, after Monti's experience in Italian government, we saw a quite remarkable rise of Eurosceptic parties, and even this parliament now is formed by a majority of Eurosceptic parties, which are the League, the far-right party led by Matteo Salvini, and the Five Star Movement, even though now they try to reshape themselves in a more moderate way. And saying this because these parties, the Five Star Movement, a bit less now, the League, and now we have in Italy, these are a big far-right party, which is the Brothers of Italy. They see Brexit, they look at Brexit as an experiment. And if Brexit results to be successful or not as damaging as it was said to be a few years ago, of course, I mean, these parties are going to gain more strength, this may happen, especially if the experience of Mario Draghi as prime minister is going to be not successful as he hopes. So, Italexit is very different. I mean, it's less likely. I mean, sorry, than the Brexit, because Italy has a constitution that actually rules out any referendum on international treaties. But at the same time, if in the next election that might have place. Might take place, in the next year, if there is a big majority of Eurosceptic parties, of course they could also change the constitution. So Italy looks very, very attentively, and it's very interested in what is going on here in Britain. And then there is this other thing, which you surely know. I mean, this comparison between Boris Johnson and Berlusconi, of course, and this is my last point. The very interesting thing is that Boris Johnson in Italy is beloved or despised as much as he was as Berlusconi was. So this is another side, I think, of how much Brexit is divisive and partisan, not only here in the UK, but even in Italy. And you can see that when, I mean, now, especially as Stephanie said, with what happened with the vaccines, you can feel in Italy a rising approval for Boris Johnson for the way he handled this matter. So when we, and this is my last remark, when we think about Brexit, we always have to think that this is an experiment and there are so many countries around that look at it. And so the consequences may be just beyond this country. Thank you.
Thank you, Antonello. And our last speaker is Jakub Krupa from Poland, giving us the Polish perception. Perhaps also because you're a prominent member of the Polish community here in London, you might tell us how Brexit has been viewed by Poles resident here in Britain. Jakub. Over to you.
As you can imagine, it's filled with a huge excitement and joy at all the paperwork that you have to complete and send to the Home Office. Let me just start with saying that it's absolutely great to be here tonight with you, and thank you for the invitation. I just realised, preparing for the event, that it's 10 years since I studied at the UCL. So it's great to be back in another role. I think when talking about Poland and Poland's approach to Brexit, I think you have to remember that, and again, obviously, each and every one of us said that, Poland believes to have a very special relationship with the UK, which is not always kind of reciprocated in the way Poland would want it to be, but it goes back all the way to, you know, the Second World War, obviously, and the huge waves of Polish migration back then. But particularly, it is something that has become a big topic in Polish political debate since 2004 and since Poland's accession to the EU, when obviously UK was one of the first countries to open the labour market to Poles, and obviously, as we know, they've come in huge numbers. And since then, there was always a debate about Poles in the UK and about Poland's relationship with the UK. And apart from many other kind of practical reasons of, you know, people working here, people having families and so on, there's a very clear electoral motivation in that. So whenever you have an election, UK was always kind of a reference point, saying if you as a political party can win back people who are in the UK, then you are seen as the party that is fit to rule Poland and govern Poland. And in the last few years, particularly around the Brexit debate, obviously Poland has been ruled by Law and Justice, a conservative Eurosceptic party that has been aligned with the Conservatives for many, many years, sitting together in the European Parliament. So for them, it was a fairly interesting experience, because when you think about it, that Law and Justice kind of came to power in Poland in very kind of simple terms, because that's not what we're talking about here, but came to power basically saying, you know, we need sovereignty, we need to decide about our own matters, but also we need to spend more money in the kind of what probably Theresa May would call just about managing or people kind of forgotten behind, you know, and left behind by other processes. And in that sense, it's very interesting to see that dynamic between Euroscepticism of the party and kind of conservative, culturally conservative approach to social spending. And obviously that's where Law and Justice in Poland differs from the UK. But going back to Brexit more specifically, it's interesting because obviously the party itself is the Law and Justice Party, the government in Poland is very Eurosceptic. But at the same time, Poland has one of the highest levels, if not the highest level of pro-European attitudes, and that's obviously because of historical reasons, because of historical aspiration to be part of the EU, which is slightly different than in most of the other countries, where they kind of always see themselves as part of the EU, whatever happens, and you know, they've been there forever. For Poland, it was always kind of aspirational part of political debate, and therefore, you know, even now, after all these problems, the level of support for the EU is at 80 to 90%, which is massive, and literally, I think since Poland joined in 2004, maybe there were two or three public opinion polls saying that if something happened, then potentially Poland would vote to leave. But other than that, always very, very high level of support. And that kind of created a very weird level of interaction. And Poland was kind of trying to play along with UK, saying we're gonna support you, we're gonna help you negotiate stuff. We'll be helping you to reach other countries in the region, Central Eastern Europe, and discuss things with them. We'll be trying to be, you know, advocating for a pragmatic Brexit, because whatever happens, we will still have, you know, a million Poles in the UK, and all these links in trade that Poland has built, particularly over the last 10 years. You know, UK is one of Poland's top five trade partners at the moment, again, despite Brexit, and that's not going to change. And in that sense, it was interesting to see that Poland was trying to play the role of a broker. Obviously, it was, particularly in Poland, it was always presented as taking care of our own people in the UK. It was less about kind of big philosophical debates about, you know, the future direction of the EU, even though Poland has always been saying, you know, we don't want to lose UK because, you know, it's a non-Eurozone conservative country calling always for reforms and for change of approach and a kind of counterbalance to France and Germany. So by losing that element, Poland now kind of is being pushed a bit towards other kind of, as one of the ministers, Polish ministers, told me, awkward squad members, so Hungary or kind of far right parties across Europe, which Poland does not particularly, Polish government does not particularly feel comfortable with, that often in terms of political views on Europe. So in that sense, losing the UK has been a problem, and obviously there's a personal element there, which I'm sure we'll come back to in one way or another, because apart from Boris Johnson, there was a second kind of big person in the whole thing. It was Donald Tusk on the EU side. And again, being this kind of massive arch rival of the Polish government, they could never say, you know, we fully agree with the EU, we will do whatever the EU wants to do in negotiations with the UK. But it was always seen through the prism of domestic politics and kind of law and justice, saying, you know, Tusk is wrong. But we kind of can't say that UK is right as well, because obviously Polish voters don't want that, and we don't want, you know, Polexit of any sort. But there's always that kind of awkward element whenever talking about Brexit. But the last point I would make on this is that I think there's recognition of the fact that this has been a long time coming in Poland. There's certain elements of kind of feeling guilty that perhaps, you know, the wave and the scale of the Polish migration to the UK may have contributed to that in a sense. And I'm sure we'll come back to the issue of migration as well. So there's this kind of, again, very awkward positioning in the whole debate. But Poland says, like, yeah, that, you know, it's interesting to see, it's great, maybe just like Boris Johnson, what he was always saying, it may be that kind of additional push for the EU to reform and kind of rethink some things. But at the same time, they're like, obviously, we would not want to do that. We were just excited by this as a kind of someone else doing this. But we, being where we are geographically, we would not want to do that at all. And I think despite Brexit, the strength of the relationship with the UK is really important, because, A, obviously, even despite Brexit, despite some departures after Brexit referendum, you still have about 800,000 to 900,000 Poles in the UK who are here, permanent residents, planning to stay. So that obviously is a massive link. And again, as I said earlier, that means you have several millions of voters back in Poland who can vote on that. But also you have things that go just beyond the EU, for example, cooperation in NATO, and security cooperation against Russia. And in that sense, I think Poland will always be kind of trying to position itself as a pragmatic ally of the UK within the EU.
Thanks to all four of you. I can see a few questions trickling in under the Q&A. But keep them coming in, because we're going to come to you, the audience, in a quarter of an hour or so. But let's just have a little discussion first with the panel. And the title of this event is European Perspectives on Brexit. You haven't talked much about the negotiations, which may seem a long time ago, but gosh, they were long and protracted and painful. So beginning with Marie and then coming to Stephanie, just tell us how the British were viewed in terms of their conduct and handling of the negotiations. Marie, you first.
Yes, well, basically, so the way the British were seen in France during the negotiation was, very much not understanding that the EU is an entity who decided to work as a team, like naming Michel Barnier to represent the role of the EU and negotiating directly with London. London wanted to talk to every capital, every country, and we were a bit unnerved by the fact that London wouldn't listen when you tell them again and again, don't talk to Emmanuel Macron, speak to Michel Barnier. That's the first thing. And also the fact that the EU has some kind of functioning, is proud of its functioning institutions, although perhaps realize that nothing is perfect, but very proud of what they have achieved since they've been created, and they want to defend their existence and the functioning the way they function. And the fact that the UK wanted to basically just say, oh yes, but for us, of course, you can do kind of an exception, you know, you can do that because that's us and you were friends and all that. And that was very unnerving for the French audience as well, because it's so complicated, the EU, that if you made the effort to try and understand how it works, and then someone throws all the toys out of the prime saying, yeah, well, let's do that differently, that's going to be even more complicated. So there was these two things that was very important. Also the fact that because we trust a lot of politicians in people, the fact that Boris Johnson took over after Theresa May was something that was a bit complicated, because Theresa May, we didn't know where she was going, but we thought she was honest. Whereas Boris Johnson, when he arrived, we thought or knew or whatever you think, that he would be dishonest and would basically pull all the tricks he could to gain what he wanted. And that's something that was very risky for us. And we thought that was very much feared. And when it happened, kind of the worst that happened when Boris Johnson became prime minister. So that was basically the three strands of the negotiation. And when it's in the end, when they found the protocol last year, and then they found the Brexit deal at the end of 2020, there was still regret, but a bit of a relief that now it's over and we can basically dedicate our time in the EU and in France to patch things that have been damaged by all this negotiation and start again. And of course, France wants to be at the forefront of restarting, reinventing the EU.
Thank you, Marie. Stephanie, anything to add?
Not much, because that was really comprehensive, to be honest. I try to, just a quick thought. What was interesting, I think, as Marie said, Michel Barnier was the chief negotiator, and it's quite impressive how the 27 stuck behind them. There was no friction in the 27. What happened, but maybe it also happened very much because of the nature of the British press. They always need some persons, and they need a bad guy and they need a good guy. So there was this kind of, so here was Barnier, and on the side was Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron. And Macron was always the bad guy, and Angela Merkel was the one who at the end of the day would sort it out. And I don't know, I think I counted once how often Theresa May was in Berlin, and then also Boris Johnson met her. And even at the very start, there was a famous meeting of a visit by David Cameron, whom Angela Merkel invited, and she does that rarely, to Merseburg, which is the outside Berlin, this beautiful residence of the German prime ministers. And she even invited him with his children. I mean, that was a real gesture. And allegedly she told him, look, it's not going to work. If you think you can renegotiate the British conditions in the European Union, it's not going to work. And the German government has put a lot of political capital in saving the relationship. It was always very, very important, as to everyone at the end of the day, but especially to Germany, also because of the economic ties, to come out of this disaster with a deal. And well, the negotiations at the end, everybody was just tired. People didn't understand. They thought, well, Britain had left on the 31st of January 2020. Why are they still in? Why there's another negotiation? So, and on top of this, Boris Johnson, who no one really trusted, At the end, there's a deal, but that deal, as we can see now, literally in these minutes, is not an oven-ready deal. And while it would be nice to start a nice, fruitful, positive relationship, it doesn't look very promising for now.
Several of you have mentioned the role of the British press, which clearly was a very important influence and motivating factor in Brexit. So since you are all professional journalists, foreign correspondents in London, let me just ask you your view of the British press and tell us how the press is perceived by yourselves and by your colleagues back home. Let's go to Antonello and then Jakub, and then we'll come back to Marie and Stephanie. Quick answers, please.
Yes, thank you. Well, this is a very interesting point, I think, because we in Italy, we don't have clear difference between broadsheets and tabloids. The main newspapers have the same, you know, features of both, you know, sides, of both kinds and sorts of British newspapers. I think that, this is something that of course the Italian public or other public, they can't see because they don't read, you know, daily British newspapers. I think that, it was very paradoxical and curious what I saw, in the Daily Mail or other tabloids. They pushed so hard for Brexit and all the consequences attached, and then when the British citizens, the British face restrictions in European countries now they just, you know, cry for, you know, for justice. They are outraged. So of course, this tells much about it.
Yes, Antonella, enough, if I may. Come quickly to Jakub. Jakub, do you have anything like the Sun or the Mail in Poland?
We do. It's sales probably slightly smaller than both of these papers in the UK. And I appreciate that Antonella's got to be careful here, because obviously his colleagues in the UK lobby will go after him whenever he says something wrong about him. But I think it was astonishing. During the referendum, before the referendum, the whole narrative about migrants and the way you had kind of all sorts of migrants of all from anywhere in the world kind of present the same way. And I remember, you know, being a migrant myself before I started working as a correspondent, and then also in my professional capacity, kind of reporting about all these scare stories of Polish people stealing Queen's swans from St. James's Park and greeting them in Hyde Park, and then kind of, you know, going somewhere else to do something outrageous elsewhere, or someone, I will forever remember that story. There was someone, I think in The Sun again, who complained that a former filming studio that was used for adult industry productions was turned into flats. And one of the flats was now occupied by a Polish family, and that's outrageous. And that's the worst thing that ever happened on that street. And I always thought, you know, that's just ridiculous. And I think that sense kind of accompanied us through the negotiations as well. A lot of people in Poland, obviously looking at the way political reporting is being done in the UK with awe and kind of very kind of respectfully following that, because it is a very good source of knowledge. But also looking at it as A, having a very weird perspective on things, and be constantly focusing and kind of obsessing about France, Germany, and ignoring all other member states, including Poland. So, you know, I remember in like 2016, 17, there was a story again about, you know, discussing what do we do with migration. And there was a story about Slovakia, and one of the newspapers thought it was appropriate to add a map of Europe pointing to where Slovakia is, because their readers haven't heard about Slovakia for the last 12 months. So I think there is this sentiment that while there's a lot of good stories there, and it definitely drives politics much more than in Poland, and I guess potentially in many other European countries, the way it presents the world is sometimes slightly cartoonish and slightly, but perhaps not necessarily fully fair to those presented by the press.
Marie, do you have to explain to your readers the peculiarities of the British press?
Well, yes, a bit. Well, of course, we know about The Sun, about the page two in particular. I think that's something that's very, was it page three? I can't remember. The naked lady is something that that was something that's known in France, for example. What's inside The Sun is a bit less known. For example, we wouldn't know if The Sun is more to the left or to the right. What we remember is that the British press is very sensational and they want to basically go out with a bang on the front page. That's something that we don't really have in France. We can Libération, for example, is a French newspaper. They like to go out with a bang, but more with a pun of word in the title. They don't have this wish to shock, basically. That's something that's very prevalent in the British press and that we don't have in France. So what you have to basically remind people, if they are aware at all of the kind of press that there is in the UK, is that those tabloids in particular are here to be sold and to catch your eye, and that even though they do that, they do have very readership basically, you come to them without being prompted. Basically, they're just very very read, and that's something that doesn't happen in France. In France, newspapers are not widely read. I mean, the reading press is going down, and we would like to be inspired in a way by the British press. Although, always to remember that basically the reason why the British press is working so well is because it likes to shock, and because all those pages that used to be basically where there were naked ladies and all that in the middle of the news is something that built reputation even if it doesn't happen. So that's something you have to remember. But also, of course, when you go into a French kiosk, what you see in terms of British newspapers, you wouldn't see The Sun. I think I never saw The Sun in a Parisian kiosk, for example. You see the FT, a very dry newspaper in a way, and pink pages, and pink pages in France are for the very dry economics of Les Echos newspaper. So you're not very drawn to this kind of newspapers. The Guardian looks like Le Monde, and the Daily Telegraph is too big to be read in the metro, for example. So, I mean, there's no, I'm not sure there's a big interest in the British press. And of course, although British said they're very bad in languages, French people are not very good in languages either. So reading in English is something that would be a bit complicated for most people. So the awareness of British press in France, I would say perhaps we should be improved if we want to understand more how the British think.
Thank you. I'm going to have one more round of questions with the panel. Let me just ask Abby about the state of questions. Abby, we did have 9 questions at one point. Now I can only see 3.
Yeah, I've just been dismissing them.
Oh, fine. Yeah,
we've got some questions.
We've got a good queue. Very good. Then quick answers, please, to a very difficult final question to each of you. How do you see the future relationship evolving? And your seasoned foreign correspondents, you know Britain very well. What do you think the prospects are of the UK at some point possibly rejoining the EU? And if it ever does rejoin, how far ahead do you think that might be? Stephanie, over to you.
These are really tricky questions. To start with the last one, when will Britain rejoin the European Union? This has to be decided in Britain, not on the continent. So I can't really see it. There is, since 2016, the polls have not moved very much. Even now, it's still more or less 50-50. I don't think that there would be a clear vote to rejoin soon. In terms of how the relationship will develop, I mean, I'm quite worried, and I'm worried because we are only 3 months after the transition period has ended, and the Northern Ireland problem was never the Northern Ireland. I remember I was a Brussels correspondent before I was went to London, and I remember a very high-ranking senior civil servant in the Commission saying, "There's no solution for Northern Ireland." And you can see it already imploding after 6 weeks. And the actions taken, I must say, more by the British government have been short-sighted, I think. They are pushing very much. Everything has to be solved quickly. There's probably a lot of pressure from the unionists and loyalists in Northern Ireland. Of course, there was this absolute terrible mistake by the German president of the Commission when she shortly triggered Article 16 in her panic about the sluggish vaccine rollout in Europe. But I mean, while I think economic relationships will find their way, it will take a long time. There are already massive damages, but somehow that will be managed. I wonder how the political relationship will develop. And I'm rather pessimistic right now.
Yeah. Marie? Could you unmute?
Sorry, my bad. I totally agree with Stephanie. Of course, rejoining the EU is something that should be decided, and we will decide it anyway in the UK. One interesting point, perhaps a very French point of view, is that what if there's no EU, for example? We know that Marine Le Pen, with her new National Rally Party, wants not to leave the EU anymore, but she wants to create a new alliance of nations. And she invited Britain to basically take part of this alliance of nations. So if she succeeded, and I'm not saying she will, but of course she's got very good ratings at the moment in terms of the next presidency in 2022. If she succeeds, of course the EU, because she wants to maybe she would want to dissolve it, or at least go perhaps with Poland and other Italy and other countries to create this alliance of nations. And the UK could find its feet in this kind of very loose union. So I think it's as possible that the UK rejoins the EU, that the alliance of nations appears one day, because I don't see the UK just changing its mind and going back. But with all the far rights going up at the moment, maybe there would be kind of a side alliance of nations that could be created, and the UK, if it's not held by the far right party, might be interested in getting close to this kind of organizations.
Thank you. Jakub, next. Tell us how you see the future.
Obviously, I have to start with the same disclaimer like everyone else. It's up to the UK to decide what it wants to do. But frankly, I wouldn't expect it to go back. Maybe I'm going too far here, but I just don't see it happening in the next few years, particularly given the amount of political capital that has been invested in this. Obviously, we know there's a new generation of voters. This may change over the next 10, 15 years. But I think there's been the rift between the UK and the EU on this. It's been so great that it would be really difficult to patch it up and kind of just forget about all of this. And I think that would be just super weird. However, and I've seen someone ask about it, I don't think, at least not Poland, I can't speak for other countries, but I don't think that there'll be any appetite to kind of punish the UK for leaving in the first place. I think Poland would be very happy. But then that goes back to what I said earlier about kind of the direction of travel for the whole of the EU. And definitely, you know, if the EU goes in the kind of federal the direction of kind of being even more integrated and kind of ever more integrated, a community, and I don't think the UK will want to go there. And also, I think there will be a lot of countries who, for now, potentially theoretically like Poland, but will be looking at what's going on in the UK, not necessarily with the view of leaving anytime soon because of their own kind of domestic issues and domestic pressures that make it extremely difficult. But I think there'll be a lot of interest in how these two kind of competing regimes, competing kind of constructs work with each other. And I think that's what, you know, what Boris Johnson said last year or this year, just hours before Brexit, about the fact that the EU will now have a competitor next to itself, including regulatory competitor, kind of, you know, whether that's changes to loads of European regulations. Now the UK will have an opportunity to look how to change it. And I'm sure there will be countries in the EU like Poland saying, look, they're doing something good, they're doing something well, perhaps you should take an inspiration from that. So I think I wouldn't expect the UK to go back. I would expect a lot of countries to look at what's going on in the UK and then sort of follow it immediately, but as a kind of inspiration to talk about the EU's direction in the future.
Antonella, forgive me, I see the questions mounting up, so I'm going to go straight to the audience.
May I just...
One quick point.
I mean, I think I fully share the concerns of Stephanie and Jakub, not only on Northern Ireland, but actually on many other issues like finance, for instance. And I strongly tend to rule out any rejoining, actually, of the UK. I must be really clear now. Into the EU, because for basically two reasons. The first one is that the UK, when it was part of the EU, had a very privileged position with opt-outs and other sorts that now is not very likely to regain in case of future rejoining. And secondly, the EU is clearly going towards much more integration, much tighter integration, which is exactly the reason why the UK left.
The UK left. Yeah. So, very good. Thanks. Abby, let's go to our first round of questions.
Okay, great. I'm going to ask Sergio, Sylvia, and Charles.
Should I speak? Yes. I just wanted to know if the speakers have any sense of relief in Europe for now that the process of Brexit is at least partially over. And actually, if, as has been mentioned already, since was always a sort of awkward membership, if there is a feeling of new opportunities opening inside the EU now.
Good question. Thank you. Sylvia, you're next. Sylvia, we can't hear you. Abby, would you like to read out Sylvia's question?
Yeah, sure. She says, what has been the most challenging aspect of reporting Brexit and how did you deal with it?
Another good question. And third, we have Charles Metcalf.
Yes. What do these distinguished correspondents see as being any of the positive aspects of Brexit, if any?
Right, thank you. So Stephanie, would you like to go first? You don't have to answer them all, whichever ones take your fancy.
I was fearing the questions about naming a positive of Brexit. I'm trying really hard and I'm really, and I think this comes back also to the correspondence job. It has been difficult for us to be really an unbiased observer of what was going on in this country. Because of Brexit and because of being EU citizens, we became constituency here. And I understand why many Europeans here, like Jakub described before, because of, and for many good reasons, felt not really welcome anymore here. And so good things of Brexit. I mean, I really want the UK to succeed. I'm very intrigued to see how this will work out, how they will get the trade deals, how the economy will be liberated and how the North will be leveled up. I'm really looking forward to that. I think it's a massive challenge. And I just wonder at the end of the day if it was worth it. In terms of challenges reporting Brexit, I think there's something very London phenomena and a Washington phenomena, which is if you are a foreign correspondent, they're really not interested in you. You don't get much access to government. It's very hard work. From time to time, it gets better. Currently, we get more briefings. Also during Brexit, we got more interviews. But in general, it is hard work to get any access. And I do know that in places like Brussels or Paris or whatever, it's much, much easier. Yeah, and I let the others speak now.
That was great. Thank you. Marie.
So totally concur what Stephanie said about the access to any personalities or briefing or anything like that. When you're a foreign correspondent in the UK, that's awful. You're always at the back of the queue and you're being told in your face, we give the priority to British press, not to EU press. So that's really a challenge, of course. I'd like to talk about the is now a sense of relief because Brexit is over. The question is, I don't think Brexit is over. I mean, we saw yesterday with the protocol that Boris Johnson said that he won't really observe with the grace period in Northern Ireland, that he said he would unilaterally extend. And of course, that infuriated the EU. So it's far from over. And the sense of relief, not really, because of course the UK has left, but now it's free to do a bit of whatever they want. And if they want to basically do a fair competition, there are mechanisms to prevent that. But I mean, the UK is thinking that well, maybe they won't go all the way to, you know, putting sanctions or taking legal action against us. So maybe we can do things here and there, just like they're doing in Northern Ireland. So they now have a loose teenager on the shore of Europe who basically feels very, very free and on the top of the world, because with the vaccine rollout and with the coronavirus now, they've done better than the EU. So they feel off top of the world. So really, yeah, not so much. Not so much, I don't think so. In terms of opportunity left because the UK left, well, they have a bit less of budget because, of course, the UK was a net contributor to the EU budget. So that's something that's basically lacking a bit. But yes, of course, I mean, if President Macron said he wanted to basically renew the EU and see more integration and all that, and he clearly wants basically to take the lead on that, there's a possibility that the EU can reinvent itself without the UK kicking and screaming everything every time they want to do something. But of course, the people have seen Brexit happening or being happening in a way, and you can see it two ways. Or you can see that the UK is not doing so well and you don't want any Frexit or Italexit and all that, and the EU is free to do what they want a bit more while reforming itself a bit. Or on the contrary, Britain managed to basically make it look like a success, and the EU is less and less popular in the population. So not relief, and in terms of opportunity, that's really meant to be seen.
Now, in coming to Jakub and then Antonello, quick answers if you would, because there may be little to add. Jakub.
Of course, very quickly, relief, I think, on Poland's side that there is a deal, however fragile it, however difficult it is, it's there. For Poland always, and the biggest line was about Polish nationals in the UK and the kind of limbo they would face if there was no deal whatsoever in the first stage, and the second stage, similarly about the level of disruption to Polish businesses exporting massive amounts of goods to the UK. So there's always been that kind of whatever we do to avoid a no-deal situation. To an extent, there was an spat with a deputy foreign minister of Poland at some point saying at one of the summits that, you know, Ireland, whatever, we just need to get a deal. Whatever happens to Ireland, it's fine. But obviously, sure, it shows a kind of very poor judgment on the side of the minister, because that, as others said, will keep coming back. I don't think there's a sense of opportunity for the EU in that and for Poland. However, and that goes back to the positive aspects of Brexit, I think there is a sense that that competition, that having someone who basically has the same or similar values to ours, even though if they, and by they, I mean the UK, look at things differently, they're close and kind of, we kind of, for the last 40 or something odd years, we've been thinking the same way. I think having that competition and someone who can diverge and looking at how they diverge could be inspirational and could be a good thing. The problem is obviously at what point the EU will see that as an opportunity, at what point it will see as continuously competition, kind of something that we should not allow or we should not follow. And the last thing about the most changing aspects of reporting on Brexit, I fully agree with previous speakers. I think there's a fascinating point there that the Downing Street, I think only 2 years after the referendum, realized that it might be a good idea to have someone who deals with international press. And they're always perplexed by the idea that we are asking, like, can you please send us the speeches before they get delivered? Can you please give us the quotes? Can you please give us something to work with? And they're absolutely puzzled by the interest and the fact that then, you know, they would get a minister from Poland come over and say, I read in the Polish reporting X, Y, and Z, and they're like, okay, so they write something and someone reads that. How does that work? And it's just this whole idea of non-English media world kept, you know, just going above the head. And also the fact that, and that's my favorite bit, the fact that Europeans read in English is something that kept surprising Downing Street and UK politicians throughout negotiations. And whenever they're looking like, we will do this fancy move and then we'll surprise the EU. And it's obviously all over the front page of the Telegraph. And the next day, all EU media pick it up and ask Downing Street, like, why did you find out about that? How do you know that we're planning to do this? And that was always slightly amusing to watch and to see.
Thank you. Antonello.
Yeah, very quickly. First on the reporting, I must say that actually I find working here much more exciting, because it's, as my colleague said, it's very difficult to, you know, enter and to get in touch with. And so, I'm a bit masochistic maybe, but when you get, you know, something, maybe it's, it's even more, you know, beautiful. On the positive effect of Brexit, well, we saw immediately one, which is with what happened with the vaccines. With vaccines, EU did a very poor job, because there were a few nations member states already in July and June ready to get, you know, doses, like it was the Netherlands, Italy and Germany. And then the EU came and said, no, we have to buy all together with the everyone, which is fair point. But of course, now we see the differences. I mean, the UK is much ahead on the vaccination program, and while the EU is lagging behind. The other point is the relief. Well, of course, I mean, there is a much sense of relief in EU because this story is over, because it was a bit exhausting. But at the same time, I really feel deep sorrow, especially among the youngest generations, because they know that they are not going to have any more the same opportunities that other youngsters had in the previous years for study, for work. Yeah. And so this is very important, I think.
And I should say, we miss our Erasmus students. We will miss them very, very much. Yeah. Abby, next round, please.
Okay, fab. So I've had a few of the same questions, so I'm going to read it out. They said, if Scotland and Wales pursue independence and Ireland reunites, would the EU accept their request to join? And then I'm going to ask Sam Dixon to ask his question, and then Pernilla.
Sam, your question, please. No, we're not. Yes.
Oh, hi. So I was just wondering, if more and more countries continue to leave the EU, how many countries would have to leave before the EU becomes redundant?
Okay, rather sharp question. Yeah. And next, could we have a question from Pernilla, please?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, speak up.
Yeah, I was wondering, without the UK pushing for differentiated integration, and we've seen the UK being one of the major players for differentiated integration, how's that going to counterbalance Denmark and all the other countries that are proponents of differentiated integration? So where is integration going, and which path and which in which way is it going? Yeah.
Very good. Stephanie, could we come to you first on this round?
Yes. Pretty complex questions for
you don't
90
have
seconds?
To answer them all.
Okay, Scotland and Wales. I mean, I think Wales is not so much the question, but Scotland might become the question. Of course, they could probably join, but they would have to go through the normal process of accession. When you now talk to politicians on the continent, whether they would want Scotland to be an EU member, you would be surprised about the resistance. There is not much interest. There is not much. I mean, you have the problem of Catalonia in Spain. Mm-hmm. I haven't found much encouragement for that, but that might change. When is the EU redundant? Well, I guess when France and Germany leave. I do not see the EU disintegrating, and maybe I answer also the other questions with that. What I do see is more and more clubs. So you have the Frugal Four when it comes to economic questions and the euro. You have the Visegrad countries, Poland, Slovakia, Czech Republic, and Jakob, who's the fourth one? I was like Hungary, of course. Yeah. They do their own policies together. Then you have the German-French bridge, so to say, which works on machine. That works more or less well. It always works very well when the Germans pay. So there are a lot of different interests, and they will become stronger and stronger, and the EU has to find a compromise. But just as a last thought, one thing that Britain, I think, never really understood is compromise, and that the countries on the continent, like my country, has only coalition governments, and you always fight and you always argue, and at the end of the day, you find a compromise. And that is something that, and I don't say that's a bad thing, but it's something you have the House of Commons, one side and the other side, and they fight each other and one side wins. It's not about compromise.
Yeah, and that's partly our majoritarian electoral system, which leads to that very adversarial and majoritarian political culture. Jakub, you're next.
Yes. So in terms of disintegrating, obviously there's been a lot of talk about, you know, UK leaves and then others will follow. I think Brexit has been a bit of a cautionary tale for others as well, that, you know, departure is not that easy. And that's something that I genuinely heard in a number of capitals in Europe, that even if the UK civil service struggled with that, how would we cope with it? If the UK machinery of the government struggled with negotiations and kind of, you know, disentangling everything after so many years and kind of finding the right way to deal with it, then surely, you know, as much as I love all my Polish friends and diplomats, we would struggle with that as well. And I think that's been a kind of cautionary tale for that, in that sense, for many countries to follow. How many would need to go? I think if any out of the big countries goes, that would be a massive, massive warning moment. And there's always this fear of a kind of domino of countries. But I guess what Stephanie said there about kind of clubs and kind of coalitions, that's something to look out for, because they'll be kind of increasingly different from each other. And we see that there's an increasing number of confrontations between them as well. And that kind of creates tension within the EU. So whether that ends with any of them leaving the EU or not, that there's kind of also the risk of them imploding from within in that sense. And on Scotland, again, fully agree with Stephanie. I think you'd be surprised to see that as much as there's a lot of sympathy and a lot of kind of friendly feelings towards Scotland as a kind of theoretical concept, yes. I think there would be always this kind of element of looking at how the UK feels about it. And if the UK says, yes, whatever, fine, you go, then I'm sure the EU would accept that. But if there's any kind of element of confrontation, like with Catalonia and Spain, for example, whatever, I think there will be a number of countries, be it Spain, be it Slovakia, looking at the kind of Hungarian part of Slovakia, feel like this perhaps is not the best idea to do this.
I'm going to come to Antonella next, and then Marie. Quick answers, if you would, because I want to fit in one more round of questions.
Yes. On EU, I think that, I mean, the EU is as now, I mean, a fork in the road. I mean, that EU has to understand what EU is going to be in the next years, because the most important point is the financial integration, which is the cornerstone of the next project of EU, but I think that it is going to face much resistance, and so I mean, the EU will really become a super state, or will stay like that, or going backwards. We'll see. Also, because Angela Merkel is leaving, now we have Draghi, so many things are changing. So it's very hard to predict, I think. On Scotland, I am quite skeptical on the independence mainly two reasons. First, because I don't think that Scotland wants to be a new Catalonia, and at the same time, I don't think that Boris Johnson and its government and his government, they are going to approve a new referendum anytime soon. And also, I think that I have the feeling that people are quite tired now after 4-5 exhausting years related to Brexit. So I think, now polls are really, really, you know, positive and really, you know, are encouraging independence. But at the same time, I mean, I think that when people are will be called, I mean, to vote, I think that they're going to be tired, so they are going to change their minds.
Thank you. On the question whether Scotland might become independent, let me give a quick trailer for the next Constitution Unit seminar on Monday, the 22nd of March at lunchtime, which is under the heading "Can Johnson Stop IndyRef 2, a Second Scottish Independence Referendum?" So anyone in the audience interested in that question, you can look on the Constitution Unit website for details of that lunchtime seminar. Marie.
I think the question of Scotland is very important. I'm going to answer very quickly all the three questions with a very French-centered way of putting things. For Scotland, I think it's very interesting in France, because a few days ago, there was a militia, Farad militia, that was dissolved by the Council of Ministers, Génération Identitaire, Generation Identity. And I remember when I went in Scotland to cover the referendum in 2014, I met with young people from this far-right group, and they were saying, that's the way, basically, we did. They were for Corsica independence, sort of that we need to do like Scotland, even though they didn't succeed, we need to do the same thing. I didn't know about this group. It was created in 2012. I left France in 2011, so I didn't know about it. I realized afterward it was a far right group. It's very interesting, you know, from France's point of view, that you can be pro-independence, pro your own nation without being a nationalist, without being far right. I think that's very, very much why we are very interested into what's happening in Scotland. And we should be aware of comparing to perhaps Spain, because we see what happens. But what's important for people from the SNP and people pro-independence over there is that whatever happens, however the referendum happens, it has to be legal for the EU, because why they want independence now to go back to the EU. So we'll see what happens, but that's the main thing for them, and that's very interesting for a French point of view. In terms of the residency and countries leaving the EU, well, we'll see if any does, because of course Brexit was a bit more popular in 2016, but in 2017 70% of French were against Brexit. And 2 years ago, 64 French people for the EU was positive. So Brexit is not happening anytime soon. And I don't think any other country is on the brink of leaving. In terms of integration, France definitely wants to lead the way into a multi-speed Europe. Macron really wants to be the one who leads that. So we'll see if that happens. But he definitely wants more integration, but staggered integration, if I can say.
Now, panel, if you don't mind going into 5 minutes of injury time, we'll do one more round of questions. Abby.
Yeah, I've just got two questions. So someone's just asked us to comment on the possibility of Sweden leaving the EU. And then I'm going to ask G. Leslie to talk and ask their question.
G. Leslie, we can't hear you.
I was going to ask about the possibility of Serbia becoming a member. What would be the preconditions? Would it have to recognize Kosovo as a separate state? And also the tricky situation of Ukraine. Would it be would there be a disinclination to consider it as a member, because it would be quite possible for there to be reignition of fighting in eastern Ukraine were membership of the EU sought? So how would it do? So would this be something they would not really wish to think about until there was clear peace in Ukraine? I'll leave it at that. I won't mention Turkey, because I can't imagine that being something which would be considered with Erdogan being around at the moment, but that's another matter.
So in this final round, very specific questions about the accession of Serbia and possibly Ukraine, and about the possible departure of Sweden. Stephanie, would you like to go first?
Hi, it's first time I'm confronted with the question about Sweden leaving the European Union, I must admit.
It was a surprise to me too.
Yeah, but so I can't say much about that. In terms of Ukraine, I was a Brussels correspondent almost 10 years ago, and then already it was a big question. And then finally, there was the association agreement, and what followed was then the annexation of the Crimea. So I think everybody is very careful to on a very, very difficult territory there. And in terms of Serbia and Kosovo, I must admit, I don't know where negotiations are now. I think definitely Serbia would have to recognize Kosovo. And again, I think there is a stalemate, and there is very little appetite anyway in the European Union for more accession. So I don't think that on the enlargement chapter, there is much happening in the foreseeable future.
Thank you. And our remaining panelists are taking the order, Marie, and then Jakub, and then Antonello.
Regarding Sweden, I never really heard about that really, but I just Googled it very quickly. And what I found is a few articles of tabloids saying that the EU faced a Swexit after Sweden said that if Brexit happens, we want to leave. And because I don't know much about Sweden, I'm going to talk about the way the British press is talking about all those countries who would want to leave, just like the UK, and the UK tracing the way basically for other countries. And if you read a bit more at the Express article, they say that 36% of Swedish people want to leave. So not much, basically, of a wish perhaps to leave for Sweden. But of course, perhaps coronavirus changed a few things, because of course we know Sweden had a very different way of doing things during the crisis. So in a way, does it will it basically just feed the fire of people who would like to be a bit different? I wouldn't know. I don't know how important Sweden is in a budget in the EU, but that doesn't really matter, because whoever it is who wants to leave, the EU wouldn't want them to leave. They wouldn't be happy to do the compromises they were willing to do for David Cameron before the Brexit referendum, because they know it doesn't work. But they definitely don't want to leave any other members. In terms of new members coming in, that could feed basically your skeptic sentiments. So because they don't want existing members to leave, perhaps opening to new members might take a bit of time after the trauma of Brexit.
Interesting. Jakob, thank you.
Yes, very quickly. I mean, on Sweden, I plead ignorance. I don't know about Sweden's intention or willingness to go and leave the EU. So I can't comment on this in a way that would bring anything new to the discussion, I'm afraid. In terms of Serbia and Kosovo, I mean, let's remind ourselves that there's a number of countries in the EU that do not recognize Kosovo. So I'm not entirely sure if that's something that necessarily has to happen. I think that the problem is broader than, and obviously, we know of both Chinese and Russian rule in Serbia currently in kind of making sure that people do not fall in love with the EU too much. And we've seen that even now with the vaccine rollout. I think the first delivery to Serbia was not in any way linked to the EU, but it was, I believe, from China. And also I think they're talking to Russia about their vaccine. So I think there's a kind of active struggle in terms of what's going to happen with Serbia. And I don't think there's much appetite in the EU at the moment, at least, to deal with this, sadly, because I would love to see Serbia as part of the EU one day. And in terms of Ukraine, again, Poland, as I'm sure you know, Poland and Sweden, particularly for years, been supportive of Ukraine's membership in the European Union and kind of the Eastern Partnership and the Eastern Flank, and partnership flank is for NATO. But there is this problem, obviously, with Ukraine, the conflict there. Poland's been saying and talking about it loudly for years, but there are several countries that kind of seem to, to much the frustration of Poland and the Polish government, seem to kind of accept that this has happened and, you know, this is what we have to deal with. And I think there will be a number of kind of high profile clashes with Russia over Ukraine, but also over things like Nord Stream, which will be partially about kind of, you know, how do we see the role of Russia in the region? And then obviously that's also about Ukraine. And also one final thought, because I know we need to wrap it up shortly, but I've seen there's a question as well about EU citizens in the UK. And I think to end on a positive note there in the Q&A, I think those people who stay in the UK, and it looks like this will be a very substantial number and there's a very substantial majority of those who are resident in the UK, I think they will not disappear, as someone suggested in the question, but they'll be even more visible, because obviously you will have generations of people born in the UK to EU parents. So I think in a sense, and maybe that may call me naive, maybe I am naive, but I hope the way they are perceived will change, and will change to a positive one as they kind of integrate more, but also are seen more as more integrated, despite of outside they were integrated before as well. But they'll be seen as integrated when you have tens of thousands of second generation, for example, Polish, British kids in UK schools. And you'll see how that kind of, you will see more experts or whatever, football players with Polish sounding names. And that, I hope that with the toxicity of the Brexit debate removed from that, at least for now, we'll be able to kind of look at that population of EU citizens in a different way. And obviously many of them are becoming British as well.
Thank you. Antonello, very quick final word.
Yeah, very quick. I mean, I'm not very expert on Sweden and Ukraine, so I don't think that I'm going to say something, anything intelligent. But on Serbia, I think it's very interesting because Serbia, if you see, now their vaccination rate is really high. They are vaccinating faster than EU, and this because of China's help, because China is helping massively Serbia. And this is, I think, very important because for two reasons. One is the penetration of China when EU leaves gaps or you know, something that they can jump onto it. And then secondly, the as we know, I mean, EU has a particular relationship with China, because they had this deal with them with Beijing, and so this is another very important point for the future of Europe. Which kind of relationship with China EU is going to have? Because we see that here in the UK and in the US, there is the ground for a new sort of Cold War with China.
Thank you. On that note, we must end. Apologies for those whose questions we couldn't reach. And before I thank our speakers, let me just give two trailers for future events. Our next event, organised with the UCL's European Institute, is on a related topic, how the EU has handled the COVID epidemic, which has been a real test for European cooperation. And that's on the 25th of March at 6 p.m. Our seminar next week is on smarter government, with former government minister Nick Herbert and two other commissioners from his Commission for Smart Government. And that's next Thursday at 6 p.m. But finally, let me thank tonight's speakers for their really interesting series of different European perspectives on Brexit, and also for telling us something about the highs and lows of being a foreign correspondent here in London. So many thanks to Marie Billon, to Stephanie Bolton, to Antonella Guerrera, and last but not least, to Jakub Krupa. Thank you, all of you, and many thanks, and good night.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Many thanks, all of you.
Good night. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you. Good night.